Good morning. This is Bob. I'll be reading the July 8, 2016 Decatur Herald and Review. First, I'd like to read an article, Dallas Police Say Snipers Kill Four Officers at Protest. At least two snipers opened fire on police officers during protest in Dallas on Thursday night, killing four officers and injuring seven others, police said. Police said a suspect was in custody late Thursday night. Dallas Police Chief David Brown told reporters the snipers fired ambush style upon the officers. He said police had a suspect cornered and were negotiating with him. Brown said 11 officers were shot, three of them fatally. Police later tweeted that a fourth officer had died. The gunfire broke out around 8:45 p.m. Thursday, while hundreds of people were gathered to protest police shootings this week in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and suburban St. Paul, Minnesota. The protesters had gathered after a Minnesota officer on Wednesday fatally shot Philando Castillo while he was in a car with a woman and child in St. Paul suburb. The aftermath of the shooting was purportedly live-streamed in a widely shared Facebook video. A day earlier, Alton Sterling was shot in Louisiana after being pinned to the pavement by two white officers. That, too, was captured on cell phone video. Video shootage from the scene showed that the protesters were marching along a street in downtown about a half mile from Dallas City Hall when the shots erupted and the crowd scattered, seeking cover. Texas Governor Greg Abbott released a statement saying he has directed the Texas Department of Public Safety director to offer whatever assistance the city of Dallas needs at this time. In times like this, we must remember and emphasize the importance of uniting as Americans, Abbott said. The search for the gunmen stretched throughout downtown, an area of hotels, restaurants, business, and some residential apartments. The scene was chaotic, with helicopters hovering overhead and officers with automatic rifles on the street corners. Everyone just started running, Devante Odom told the Dallas Morning News. We lost touch with two of our friends just trying to get out of there. Carlos Harris, who lives in downtown, told the newspaper that the shooters were strategic. It was the tap, tap, pause. The gunshots in Dallas came amid protest nationwide over recent police shootings. In Midtown Manhattan, protesters first gathered in Union Square Park, where they chanted, "The people united, never be divided." And what do we want? Justice. When do we want it now? A group of protesters then left the park and began marching up Fifth Avenue, blocking traffic during the height of rush hour as police scrambled to keep up. Another group headed through Herald Square and Times Square, where several arrests were made. Our next article from the front page of the Decatur Herald and Review, Donation Shortfall Forces Homeless Ministry to Downsize. The nonprofit corporation behind the Water Street Mission has had to make many adjustments since its homeless shelter opened at 758 North Water Street in 1989. None have been as major, however, as the downsizing that has taken place in the past couple weeks, which has included closure of the Pershing Road Mission for homeless men and Grace House for homeless women and children. Speaking on behalf of Decatur Cares Rescue Mission, the Reverend Doug Lowry of Marantha Assembly of God said Thursday, no homeless people were put out onto the street. Instead, he said, other shelter was found for the two women staying at 758 North Water. so the ministry could return its home base downtown to its original function as an emergency shelter for homeless men and move the five men at Pershing Road Mission there. And a evening worship service and meal here have also been restored Monday through Saturday. We have been forced to temporarily suspend service for women and children until we can get our financial footing a little stronger, he said. We do want to see Grace House reopen going forward. Lowry said financial pressures have also caused the closure of the Hope's Attic 2 thrift store at 1029 North Water Street, throwing into question plans to move the other Hope's Attic to a larger space vacated by Dollar General at 2922 North Martin Luther King Jr. Drive, and ended an on-the-job training program for homeless residents at Decatur Cares Auto, a related business that has already closed its service center. We tried to do too much, Lowry said. We need to stay true to our original vision of helping people on a night-to-night basis and referring them to other ministries for longer-range help. Contacted by the Herald and Review, Paul Barnes of the Decatur Cares Rescue Mission Board referred all questions to Lowry. Jonathan Kelm, executive director of Decatur Cares for the past 2 years, said he will resign July 21st to begin a new ministry in Charlotte, North Carolina. He said he will continue to operate his used car dealership at Decatur Cares Auto while he and his family transition to the new home. My mission is to give homeless people more than a place to sleep, Kelm said. Lowry said the ministry's financial problems can be traced to the decision in 2013, a year before Kelm was hired, to accept donation of the former Work Release Center for the Decatur Corrections at 275 East Pershing Road and renovate the building for use as the main shelter for Decatur Cares. The cost to operate such a massive building needed to exceed donations early in the calendar year, Lowry said, but this year grew to $5,000 to $6,000 shortfall each month, an amount the corporation board did not believe could be made up by holiday giving at the end of the year. He said the deficit stands at about $30,000 and its growth has been halted by closing the Pershing Road facility and putting the building on the market. Decatur Care Rescue Mission has experienced upheaval before, most notably when it closed its former Water Street Mission thrift store on August 31, 2005, and lost its then executive director, who resigned the same day. Summertime is always a hard time for donations, Lowry said. People are busy, and they think homeless people are not in peril, but our bills stay the same month after. There aren't many left who remember that flight or the Moody's lives after it, but those who do and the family the Moody's have left in the area are interested in preserving their memories. Recently, a video was produced that's available on YouTube. Search Breaking Endurance Moody Brothers Flight, and an exhibit of Moody photos and memorabilia is being assembled at the Macon County History Museum by director Nathan Pierce. Those things have helped bring the story back to life, Decatur Airport Director Tim Wright said. Hunter Moody became interested in flying at 9 years old, inspired by Charles Lindbergh's flight to Paris. Moody started taking flying lessons at Killick Field near Weichel's corner at 14, soloed at 15, and received an instructor rating at 16. In 1934, Hunter became the youngest licensed transport pilot in the United States at age 20. That year, he also leased the Bearsdale Airport, also known as Moody Airport, and offered instructions and chartered services. Anyone close to Hunter learned to fly. He taught his father, sisters, brother, and later his stepson and second wife. "As soon as I got into the family, he taught me to fly," said Tom Davy, Hunter's stepson. "He flew back and forth so much, he wanted everyone to learn in case there was an emergency and someone needed to land the plane. Well, you've heard stories of husbands teaching their wives to drive. When he was teaching my mom, there was a lot of yelling and screaming. I can remember in the back of a plane, and we're spinning towards the ground. Mother had the wheel pulled back, and he's yelling, 'You're going to kill us all if you don't let go of that damn wheel.' She finally got her license, but I don't think she ever did fly after that." In 1939, Hunter caught endurance flying fever. How and why exactly, no one is sure. It was just something that hadn't been done, said Bob Waddell, a friend of the Moody brothers, who witnessed the Moody endurance flight in person after talking his parents into taking him to the Springfield Airport. Hunter made several attempts to set the record with Wilbur Parrish. In June 1939, they made it 156 hours, but motor trouble stopped the flight short. After that flight, Parrish sold his interest in Miss Springfield, but Hunter quickly found a new partner in his brother Humphrey, known better as Hump. Hunter had taught Humphrey a year earlier to fly. When he started the endurance flight, he didn't have enough hours to qualify as a pilot. By the time they landed, he did. The Moody's took off from the Springfield's airport, the field off Chatham Road, later known as Southwest Airport, and flew to Jacksonville, then north to Mason City, and south to Taylorville and Litchfield, repeating similar routes over and over. During the two weeks, newspapers across the country had daily updates. Shortwave radio broadcasts from the plane were retransmitted five times a day by Springfield radio station WCBS, and movies of the flight were shown at local theaters. The process of fueled endurance flying is much more complex than it sounds. To receive gas, oil, and food, meals were made by Hunter's wife, Dorothy. The pilot dipped the plane as close to the ground as possible, and a rope was dropped. A Ford pickup truck drove under the plane at the same speed, 70 miles per hour, and supplies were tied to the rope. 2 gallons of gas was the maximum that could be attached to the rope. Though there was a scare when the plane almost crashed into a cornfield, and another time 2 holes were torn in the wing fabric, contact attempts were the easy part. The number of successful contacts were kept track of. It worked at a rate of 95%, 777 of 810 attempts. Now we will turn to some Macon County and Decatur news. Macon County asked departments for major budget cuts. The dark clouds that Macon County officials have warned about for years have finally arrived. That's the message being received this week, as department heads are being asked to cut up to 7% from their budgets for the upcoming fiscal year. That decision came after the county's finance committee determined earlier this week the need to reduce overall general fund expenses by $1.57 million. While this year will be quite painful for everyone inside Macon County government, our main goal is to do the right thing for our taxpayers and citizens, said County Board Chairman Kevin Greenfield. Officeholders will be challenged to do more with less. sacrifices will be shared for all. Heads of the more than a dozen county offices, ranging from sheriff's office to the county clerk and auditor, will begin work on their budgets for the fiscal year begins December 1st. Initial budgets must be submitted to the auditor's office by the end of the month, with 5 budget hearings set to be held biweekly from early August through October. The request for a 7% cut is not across the board, as Finance Chairman Jay Dunn said they are going on a case-by-case basis for how long the department's reduction should be. The county clerk's office was asked to cut 27% from its office, while the sheriff's office has been asked to cut 7%. Only the coroner's office will be allowed to increase an increase of $20,000, which Dunn said was due to the office squeaking by for several years. It remains to be seen how county departments will reduce their budgets, even though Dunn said layoffs are not out of the question. The writing has been on the wall for years, as sale taxes and income receipts have continued to decline throughout the Decatur region. Money owed from the state of Illinois for various obligations has also slowed due to Illinois not having a budget for more than a year. After it built up a rainy day buildup of more than $10 million in 2012, the county reduced its general property tax levy more than $1.3 million, providing relief for taxpayers. That lower rate was held for 3 years before it was raised by 11% last fall. The county entered the current fiscal year with a general fund balance of $5.4 million, nearly $3 million less than the beginning of the previous year and its lowest point since 2007. The next local story from Decatur. Teen arrested for allegedly punching man carrying loaded gun, cannabis. Drake O. Reed, an 18-year-old Decatur man, was arrested on multiple felony charges after police found him with a loaded handgun, marijuana, and a scale after he allegedly punched a 20-year-old man in the mouth. About 9 p.m. June 29th, a Decatur patrol officers were sent to Wedgwood Court after a battery incident occurred. The two men continued to argue after police arrived. Officers observed the victim to have a swollen, bloody abrasion to the inside of his lower lip, said a probable cause affidavit by Officer Clinton Babb. The victim said that Reed punched him. They were separated by another person. Drake then walked over to his bag and pulled out a small handgun, the victim told police. Drake pointed the gun at his face. He swatted the gun away from him, and they again were separated. As officers were speaking with the victim, they noticed that Reed walked along the side of the residence, picked up a pink and black drawstring bag, and carry it to the rear patio. Reed then fled from the scene. Officers found the bag in a tree about 10 feet from where they last saw Reed. A short time later, Reed returned to the scene. He told police he was on probation and did not wish to get into any more trouble. Inside the bag, officers found a .380 caliber pistol with 5 live rounds in its magazine. The bag also contained about 2.25 ounces of marijuana, a digital scale, and $784.30 in cash. Reed was arrested and booked into Macon County Jail on preliminary charges, including battery, aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, manufactured delivery of cannabis, 30 to 500 grams, and unlawful use of a weapon. He was released from custody after posting $1,500 cash bail. His arraignment is scheduled for August 2nd. He is serving a 1-year supervision term from a juvenile adjudication December 17th on charges of aggravated battery and deadly weapon. The next article, also from Decatur, a woman faces felony domestic battery charge for allegedly attacking a child. A 42-year-old Decatur woman was arraigned Wednesday in Macon County Circuit Court on a felony charge of domestic battery with a prior domestic battery conviction for allegedly dragging an adolescent girl by her hair and punching her in the face. Decatur patrol officers were dispatched to Castle Court on a report of domestic violence about 9:45 p.m. June 29th, when Officer Megan Welch made contact with Renardo Jackson. She was walking in the roadway towards Hilton Street with a heavy odor of alcoholic beverages on her breath, slurred speech, and an unsteady gait. She acknowledged to Welch that she beat the rear end of the victim and jerked her to the ground by her hair. The victim told police that Jackson grabbed her forcefully by her braids and jerked her violently back and forth. She said the force of this attack caused immediate pain to her scalp and head area. She said she screamed for someone to call the police and was trying to hit Jackson so she could break free and call the police. A witness reported to police that she saw Jackson pull the victim from the residence, dragging her by her hair. Jackson yelled at the victim as she dragged her. Once she was outside, Jackson began to strike the victim in the face with her hands. The witness said she was certain that Jackson slapped the victim and thought she also saw her punching the victim. The witness said she could hear the sound of Jackson slapping the victim's face. Jackson was convicted in 2011 of two counts of domestic battery for grabbing a man around his neck and shoulders and striking a young girl in her arm during the same incident. She was sentenced to 18 months on probation. She is being held in Macon County Jail on a $7,500 bond pending her appearance for a preliminary hearing July 20th. Now we will turn to some international news. As Baghdad protests mount, attack on Shiite shrine kills 26. Protests and anger over the security situation in Iraq mounted Thursday at the site of a massive truck bombing by the Islamic State group earlier this week in Baghdad that killed scores as the death tolls continue to rise, and a separate attack north of Baghdad killed dozens more. The Baghdad attack last Sunday, the deadliest attack in Iraq since 2003 U.S.-led invasion, stoked public unrest and spurred Iraqi officials to announce a number of new security measures. However, smaller-scale bombings and attacks have persisted in the days that followed. Late on Thursday night, an attack carried out by multiple suicide bombers and gunmen on a Shiite shrine in Balad, north of Baghdad, killed 26 and wounded 52, according to Iraqi police and hospital officials. Earlier on Thursday, Iraq hospital and police officials said their death toll from Sunday's Baghdad attack now stood at 186, with around 20 people still missing as more remains were recovered from the rubble. The officials spoke on a condition of anonymity as they were not authorized to talk to the media. However, Ahmad Rodani from the Health Ministry's media office said the military death toll is 292. The discrepancies in the numbers could not immediately be reconciled. Many of those killed have had to be identified with DNA testing because their bodies were burned beyond recognition. On Thursday evening, a crowd of angry friends and family members of the victims tried tried to push into one of the buildings hit on the track on the truck bombing cuts, but civilian volunteers held them back. The ISIS suicide bomber had detonated his explosives in Baghdad's central Karada neighborhood outside a shopping mall in a street crammed with people preparing for the Muslim holiday of Eid al-Fitr. The area packed with shops, cafes, and restaurants had swelled overnight with Baghdad residents eager from a respite from the daily fasting during the holy month of Ramadan. Mustafa Hassan, one of the men gathered at the scene on Thursday, said he had volunteered to help sift through the debris after authorities failed to do so. Hassan, a young man wearing a surgical mask and gloves, held up two plastic bags that he believed contained charred human flesh. Rudani said the Ministry of Health concerns continue to help transport the remains of the dead to Baghdad's forensic lab or to the city morgue, but he said the scale of the explosion has overwhelmed the teams who normally respond to such attacks. Till now, there are maybe still some dead under the building. We don't know, Rudani said. But Hassan, who said he had been coming every day to the site of the attack, insisted the only firefighters were seen at the site, no one else. As he spoke to reporters, a man behind him pushed past an improvised barrier and ran into the burned-out building. He's looking for his wife. She's still missing. He wants to find anything, even just an earring, Hassan said. Moments later, the man was carried out of the building by a group of volunteers. Hassan said he had actually fainted from grief. It happens a lot here, he added. Hundreds gathered in the street chanting religious slogans and waved Iraqi and Shiite militia flags. Hours after the bombing, the Islamic State said it had targeted Shiites, whom the extremist Sunni groups considered apostates. Many of the Karada victims were Shiites, but many Sunnis and Christians were among the dead. Other groups in Karada on Thursday also blamed the government for failing to secure this. People are getting more and more angry, said Hussein Samir, 24. Every day that people have to think about this tragedy, it just makes them more upset. After the Baghdad attack, Iraqi Prime Minister Hader al-Abadi announced new measures, including that much-disputed bomb detection wands would no longer be used by security forces. Experts have repeatedly pronounced the wand bogus. Al-Abadi said aerial scanning measures would be stepped up to improve intelligence gathered in Baghdad and that the ring of checkpoints around the capital would be tightened. It is unclear if any of those measures have yet been implemented. Last Thursday night, the Balad attack began when a suicide bomber targeted policemen guarding the entrance to Syed Muhammad Shrine, 50 miles north of the capital, Baghdad. A second bomber entered the shrine with 9 gunmen, targeting security forces as well as families gathering to celebrate Eid al-Fitr, the holiday marking the end of the holy month of Ramadan. Police officials said a third bomber was killed during the detonation of explosives. I will be concluding now the first part of the Decatur Herald and Review, July 8, 2016, and we will return with the second part of the Herald and Review.